Please support. I'm Randolph Barnhart, and I represent the, it's pronounced Chanel, not Chanel. Thank you, Your Honor. This is a case about Rule 26A1B, and it's a case about what was not disclosed by Ford Motor Company, not what was disclosed by Ford Motor Company. I have to say that the first place I turn to address the 26A1B issues is the Colorado Practice Manual and the article or the section that was written by Judge Gabriel. And as it points out, that the particularity of the pleadings and the denials serve as a functional equivalent of a court-ordered interrogatories. In other words, they are the baseline to set what must be disclosed by the parties. And Judge Gabriel went on to write years ago when this was first passed that it is with the particularity of the pleadings that is the important matter. We submit that our pleadings could not have been much more particular on the issues that were raised in this case. I would cite you to the record site CD23 and paragraphs 5 through 8 of the complaint, and to CD 25 and 26, to paragraph 22 of the complaint, where we set forth in great detail what we believe the issues were, including Ford's duty to analyze data from the field of similar incidents and to report them and to take such steps as are necessary to disclose the problems to the public or to dealership. Now, Ford's answer, they deny they had such duties. They deny that they were obligated to do this. And I'm referring the court to the record site CD 57 and 58, and particularly to paragraphs 6 through 11 of Ford's answer. Should Ford say, which they have said repeatedly in this court and below, that they were confused about what the issues were that were raised by the pleadings, I would cite the court to CD 24, 54 through 57. Ford's initial disclosures were served on us in late April of 2010. We had meet and confer sessions with them about our feelings about the inadequacies of their disclosures. And my co-counsel wrote a letter to all four counsel on June 1st, and that's the reference. And there are four paragraphs in that letter, 2, 4, 6, and 8. The even numbered paragraphs, which specifically tell Ford, in case they're confused, about what we believe are the issues implicated by, that is, the issues in dispute and which implicate Rule 26. For example, paragraph 4 says, all documents, data, memo, reports, analyses relating to events of sudden unintended acceleration in vehicles equipped with the same or similar ETC as used in the 2005 Mercury Grand Marquis. Electronic throttle control system, sometimes called ETC, it's sometimes called ETCS, it's the electronic throttle control system. This system was adopted, first used by Ford in 2004 model year vehicles. The Chanel's vehicle was 2005. Before that, Ford's vehicles had a linkage. They had a mechanical linkage from the foot pedal up to the carburetor or fuel injector or what have you. And in this system, it's all electronic. It's called drive-by-wire. So there's an electronic signal sent when the person depresses the throttle, and that actuates the fuel injectors. So we then come to the next issue that Ford raises, and this has to do with the documents surrounding the so-called Stimson documents or Stimson order and that sort of thing. In May, After Ford filed its initial disclosures, we were introduced to an attorney from Detroit named Jody Schiebel. You'll see her name appears frequently, for example, on that letter that I just referenced. Ms. Schiebel was Ford's National Discovery Counsel. This is the top lawyer for Ford on discovery matters in the United States. Now, On May 7th, Ford filed a motion for protective order regarding vehicle scope and discovery. And this is found at CD 472. And in that, Ford said the appropriate scope of Ford's document production in this case, including information regarding other incidents and or consumer complaints, and warranty information should be limited to Ford models that use the same ETC system as the subject 2005 Mercury Grand Marquis. Documents relating to any other Ford model are not relevant to the claims and defenses at issue in this case, and the defenses in this case, because they are not reasonably likely to lead to admissible evidence. So we stipulated that the disclosures from Ford would be limited to 2004 model year vehicles and afterwards, because that's when they adopted the electronic throttle control system. We now, in the briefing, we now hear Ford say they can't complain about us not turning over the 1980s documents which Ford had submitted to or had in its files when it was under inquiry from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. They say, well, the plaintiffs can't complain about that because they stipulated to the discovery being limited to 2004 and after 2004 model year and afterwards.
Mr. Barnhart, if I could interrupt you, I want to hone in and hear what you're saying. In fact, the trial judge here found Ford's discovery compliance was suspicious and troubling. The court found that. So I'm willing to assume that for purposes here, but the specific issues in the case, and I guess I'd ask you to hone in on those. You know, first, your first issue is a default sanction should have been entered. I'd be curious to hear how this case is distinguishable from the Supreme Court's recent case in Pinkstaff, where the conduct was arguably egregious in that case. The trial judge granted it, struck an answer, and the Supreme Court reversed, saying it's too strong because ultimately they complied. I'm going to ask you two questions and then I want you to answer. So Pinkstaff, one, how is that distinguishable? You know, default judgment is extreme. Ultimately you got the documents. And then on Simpson, documents which you raised, I'd be curious, the court here found that there's nothing unusual or different in there than really what was presented. I've read them. It's hard to see what you didn't get to present that you already did. So would you address the specifics of your arguments on the Stimson documents and the default sanction?
Yes. With respect to your first question, Pinkstaff case, the party did ultimately comply. Here, there is no ultimate compliance. Ford did not turn over numerous key documents.
Which? Could you be specific?
The trend reports that Mr. Nevi told us about on August 18th after February of 2008. The report, and I've got a list of them here if I may have a moment, Your Honor. There's a report PT24 with PT5654. There are no memoranda or emails that were ever turned over on these subjects. None whatsoever.
Nevi, didn't he say, I reviewed trends reports, but there were none specific to the SUAs? I thought that's what he said in his deposition. Correct me, I may be wrong.
I can't challenge that. I don't recall that testimony. Right. I was sitting right there when the deposition was taken.
Okay, and I'm just relying on it.
I may be wrong on that.
He said there were trend reports, but I think he said there were none specific to the SUAs that ultimately led them to do a deeper dive, I think is what he said. Okay.
A month and a week after the deposition, they turned over six pages of trend reports. But those are the ones that stopped in February of 2008. And the next thing, Your Honor, is there is no privilege log ever filed by Ford in this case. Never. They filed one on the FMMS database, which is they claimed was the attorney's database. They did not file another one until November, and then we have the 53 pages of documents, which they say, well, we should have used them. Take a look at them, CD15632-678. I don't know how we could have used them when we get them a week for a trial and they have all these codes on them which we do not understand.
And I know I've interrupted you and I've asked you questions myself. Did you ask the court to take a day delay or a deposition in trial? I know there was an issue about continuance because of your client's age and health. Did you ask for an accommodation at all?
We could not, Your Honor. We had an all-day hearing on motions in limine scheduled for that week. He turned them over. I ordered them to be turned over just a few days before that hearing. And the background of this is the health. Mr. Shannon has had a recurrence of cancer earlier in the year. He's 81 years old. So we were stuck. Now, your second question has to do with this.
Before you answer his second question, I want to follow up on sort of the pink staff line of questioning. Are you aware of a Colorado authority where a default has been entered for a discovery violation, where the trial court repeatedly found that there was no bad faith on the part of the
No, I cannot, but the bad faith is not a requisite element according to the Fast case versus Kmart, number one. Number two, I would like, if I may, to read the trial court's ruling about this issue on default. I have no evidence or reason to believe at this point that this was any bad faith on the part of these attorneys or on the part of Ford Motor Company. I have reason to believe that the system has become so unwieldy that it becomes more and more difficult for the folks who control information to control that information, search it, find it, and produce it. That sets the standard upside down. That is directly contrary to Rule 26G on the obligation of the party and the attorneys to make certain they have done a reasonable search. We have showed you, Your Honor, repeatedly how they were reminded, Ford was reminded of what the scope of disclosures were supposed to be, and they didn't do it. And furthermore,
but again, when you put that along with the Pink Staff case where the Colorado Supreme Court reversed when they struck an answer, it seems like it's awfully narrow. And when the court continues to find there was no bad faith on the part of the defendant.
Your Honor, I submit that the second part of that statement is also wrong. It turns on its head the long line of cases which say that litigants should not be rewarded for improper record keeping. If Company A keeps good records and does its disclosure requirements properly, and Company B keeps sloppy records and says we should be excused because we keep sloppy records, that is not a legal excuse for this. And I think that the judge had the duty upside down.
But you're right, Mr. Barnard. It's not an excuse. And the court sanctioned them. The court then said, I'm going to do an in-camera review, and I'm going to weigh it heavily on your side. I'm going to defer. That was the sanction. So the court imposed a sanction. I recognize you think it should have been stronger, but you know that was what the court decided. So, I mean, the court recognized there was a discovery violation here. The issue is whether the court should have granted a default judgment against them. That's the issue.
This is the sanction that we received a week before trial. 53 pages of indecipherable, I've got them upside down, indecipherable charts.
Well, all the court can do is decide to produce them. The court reviewed every one of those documents on the privilege log in camera, and the court said, these are the ones that I think you get.
Well, why didn't he rule that they had waived their rights because they had not previously filed a privilege log? That is inexcusable. Now, oh gosh, I'm down to 2.5 minutes. Thank you.
Okay, if he...
May it please the court. This case is about whether plaintiff's crash was caused by a product error or human error.
So would you mind just introducing yourself? I have a guess who you are.
It's Teresa Warden for Ford Motor Company.
Thank you. Sorry.
No problem. At trial, plaintiffs couldn't prove a product defect, and plaintiff testified that the harder she pressed the pedal, the faster her car went. Nothing that plaintiffs just said now changes those facts. Also, nothing that plaintiffs just said now changes the fact that the trial court considered their story. It considered it before trial on their motion for default judgment. It considered it at trial when they renewed that motion, and considered it again after trial when it denied post-trial relief. The trial court rejected that story after it considered the course of the proceedings and examined the documents that plaintiffs now contend would have changed the outcome of this trial.
Well, there are more than that, counsel. I mean, and I'll ask you to hone in also. I mean, I understand the big issues, and I'll tell you, I mean, I don't think anyone in this court room doesn't have sympathy for the channels. This was terrible what happened, regardless of whose fault it was, and it was. You say in your brief, among other things, that the court, there's no evidence of discovery abuse. The court found the suspicious and troubling discovery conduct, found negligence. I'd like you to hone in on that. untroubled by the discovery problems. There was ongoing discovery problems. I recognize there's hundreds of thousands of documents. You know, why weren't the Stimson documents produced? You knew what they were. Same counsel was handling both cases. And to say now, as you kind of suggest in your brief, they weren't relevant because they were mechanical throttle systems, is to me, with all respect, somewhat disingenuous. When they got in the National Highway Transportation Safety Report saying it didn't matter, you can't have it both ways. So I would appreciate your addressing, you know, focusing this case's appeal is about discovery. There was discovery abuse. Why wasn't it prejudicial given how many documents were not produced or were produced at the last second?
Well, just the Stimson point first. Ford's not having it both ways. The Stimson documents were never discoverable because they weren't related to plaintiff's claims or Ford's defenses. Ford's defense was that this crash occurred because of human error. The 1989 study is relevant to that defense because it's one piece of evidence among many that Ford used to show that drivers may commit pedal errors. They may press the brake when they meant to press the accelerator or press the accelerator when they meant to press the brake. And that's what we contended occurred here. Plaintiff's claims, however, as set forth in their complaint and as they set forth in the Rule 16 conference and in their Rule 26A1 disclosures, were that there was a defect in the electronic throttle control system of the Mercury Grand Marquis. The Stimson documents, the Stimson case, dealt with a 1991 Aerostar van with a mechanical throttle control. The documents relevant in that case had nothing to do with whether or not there was a defect in this case and had nothing to do with whether Mrs. Channel made an error at the time of the crash. That's why the Stimson documents were never relevant.
But didn't some of them address the electronic systems? I made some notes on them. I mean, there was one, I think I wrote down, it was F7, that talked about there were studies and interactions between various electronic systems. I mean, some of them did deal with electronic systems.
They did deal with electronic systems. They were looking at the time that Stimson, the 1991 Aerostar van, had only an electronic cruise control system. So some of these documents were looking at electronic interference. It's something that Ford has always studied and whether or not it could cause unintended acceleration. That's what the trial court recognized here. The trial court didn't say to plaintiffs, you had these documents before trial, you didn't tell me about them, you didn't ask to use them, I'm just going to deny your motion for post-trial relief. The trial court looked at the documents, like Your Honor noted, and found that they didn't say anything new. They didn't add anything to the course of proceedings. They wouldn't have changed the outcome of this trial. They said some of the same things that Ford's witnesses said, is that Ford has looked at EMI, electromagnetic interference, and has not found that it causes unintended acceleration. And for that reason, the Stimson documents could not have prejudiced this case. Moreover, if plaintiffs wanted to use them, they could have alerted the court that they had the 22 exhibits to the Stimson memorandum 2 weeks before trial. They never let the court know that they had those exhibits. They thought they were pertinent. They thought they were important, even though they cited to the Stimson order in their motion in limine to exclude the NHTSA report. Therefore, whether it was imprudent or tactical to wait to use those documents, they had a chance and they didn't use it. For that reason, this court in Antolovich has said if you have a chance before trial to prevent surprise, to address surprise, whether it's to ask for a continuance or ask for some sort of accommodation, you need to use it and not wait until the trial comes out a different way and say now you want another chance. And turning to the privilege log documents, plaintiffs contend that they couldn't use the ones that were released a week before trial. Well, the fact that they were released a week before trial was in part plaintiffs' doing. They didn't challenge the privilege log until the middle of November.
But you didn't produce it till really late. I mean, why didn't you produce a 68-page privilege log long before?
It was produced on October 20th, which is at the end of discovery, not before. And it's not the privilege log of the case. It's not the privilege log of every document that Ford decided to withhold on some sort of basis throughout the case. It's a privilege log of a particular study commissioned by Ford's Office of General Counsel after this case started. It was a post-litigation study of publicly available data from NHTSA. The Office of General Counsel commissioned the study along with the Automotive Safety Office in February. They were doing work well through September. It was discovered in the course of preparing for the ASO deposition, and that's when Ford started reviewing the documents to determine whether or not there was a privilege.
I'm sorry, maybe I'm missing. I'm not sure I'm tracking. Tell me again what the privilege log was generated in response to a request. It was a deposition of, was it Mr. Nevy?
Mr. Nevy, it was Ford's corporate representative from the Automotive
right.
Safety Office.
And what was requested in that deposition that wasn't requested before that then generated the privilege log?
They requested specific reports comparing sudden unintended acceleration incidents to other manufacturers. In addition, it was a document that was a collection of documents and a study that was discovered in the course of Ford pursuing its discovery obligations to supplement its discovery and to look through, continue to produce documents that are responsive. I mean, it's a study that began after this case began. It's a study that concluded just before trial. It's also a study that the trial court looked at and said it released certain documents under a deferential standard to plaintiffs, and then the remaining documents said, these aren't so important. These aren't pertinent. These aren't damaging. There's no smoking gun here. There's nothing that's going to save your trial. So the trial court made that determination. Plaintiffs didn't even put the remaining in-camera documents in this court's record, so this court has nothing to review but the trial court's determination.
The difference. Now, the trial court was troubled and found the failure to disclose on the part of Ford suspicious. And what's the difference between finding a failure to disclose to be suspicious and an act of bad faith? And that sounds pretty...
There is a difference. The trial court found the timing to be suspicious before it looked at the documents, before it looked at the ASO privilege log documents. It was concerned that, you know, we had a very short discovery period, and this trial court was paying attention. We had no less than 3 hearings in May, June, and August to address discovery issues and make sure discovery was proceeding to get to this preferential trial date. And so the judge was concerned because a privilege log is produced at the end of discovery and not earlier, that certain charts were produced at the end of discovery and not earlier. But Rule 26 does not create an obligation to produce everything at the moment the case begins. If it did, there are parties can simply not comply, and there would be no reason to have Rules 33, Rules 34, or continuing obligations. The court recognized that the timing was suspicious, but once he looked at the documents, he found that Ford had complied with its obligations, that it did not act in bad faith in producing the privilege log when it did, and that Ford did not act in bad faith in complying with its discovery obligations. To address your particular question, there is a heightened standard for the type of severe sanctions that plaintiffs seek. That's bad faith, willfulness, intentional conduct, gross negligence, something that's really high. This court recognized that Ford was trying to comply with its discovery obligations, was complying with its discovery obligations, and in the context of the speed of discovery, 6 months of discovery in a products liability case, Ford ultimately complied. After the court examined the documents, I believe he reiterated his conclusion that no further sanctions were warranted at trial because he didn't find the documents troubling, he didn't find a smoking gun, he didn't find that Ford was trying to hide something or game the system by producing the privilege log when it did.
While we pause you, Ms. Warden, can I ask you to, on this issue about Mr. Nevy, would you address the question I asked Mr. Barnhart? Am I misremembering? There was an issue about the trend reports, and I had the impression, at least, that there were no trend reports specific to the SUAs. I could be dead wrong. I would appreciate your reacting to that.
Mr. Nevy testified that He testified in many capacities as Ford's head of Automotive Safety Office and then also Ford's critical care relations group, two groups at Ford that look at safety issues and look at issues like unintended acceleration. In one of those depositions, he said that Ford has quarterly reporting requirements to NHTSA under law, and that it has an early warning group that looks at data on a quarterly basis to determine if there's something that needs to be referred to another group in Ford to examine or reported to NHTSA. That was what he said about quarterly basis. There is a convoluted questions about quarterly trend charts, and Mr. Neubauer mentions trend charts, and he said, oh, well, we look at trend charts. That was the first board had heard of trend charts, that nomenclature being used. We had previously produced 12,000 pages of documents related to ASO's investigations of unintended acceleration in 2010 alone before his deposition. So we did a diligent search and looked for what does he mean by trend charts, and found three. Ultimately, plaintiffs were allowed...
Three related to what? I mean, are three related to SUAs, or what are these trend charts? Are they just SUAs, or all different kinds of things?
Three related to unintended acceleration reports to NHTSA.
Okay.
And plaintiffs were... Those documents were produced on September 20th, a month before discovery closed, several months before trial. Plaintiffs actually noticed a trend charts deposition, but then a week later withdrew that notice, choosing instead to file their motion for sanctions. So plaintiffs had an opportunity to conduct follow-up discovery, but chose not to do it. And ultimately, they were benefited again by the trial court's sanctions order, because they were given what was tantamount to an adverse jury instruction on the trend charts. The trial court read to the jury, you know, plaintiffs asked for quarterly trend charts. Ford produced these documents. And the jury was allowed to infer whether or not Ford had additional documents it did not produce, or whether Ford only had three such charts. So ultimately, that issue was before the jury, and the jury was left to decide what it determined occurred. There's certainly no prejudice there that would require a new trial or any other sort of relief. I can address the Pink Staff case if this court would like.
Sure.
Pink Staff is different. The allegations there were more egregious, and there the court found that default judgment was too harsh of a sanction, and that was a case that the sanction was imposed before the case went to trial. Here, this case went to trial and went before a jury, and the jury found for Ford. So to impose, not only to reverse the jury's verdict, but to enter one for plaintiffs instead would be a particularly harsh sanction for which there's no precedent in Colorado law. Unless this court has further questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time. Thank you very much.
First of all, counsel has misstated the evidence about whether or not she had her foot on the brake. Ms. Channel did. That is undisputed. There is no contrary testimony that she must have had her foot on the brake. Otherwise, she would have kept on going beyond the place where she came to rest. She did not hit a tree. She did not hit a house. If she had her foot on the accelerator, she would have been going across. And as it turns out, there was a house across the street that she would have hit. So her foot was not on the accelerator. Secondly, and we have not discussed this hardly at all, we have the admissibility of the NHTSA study at all. Okay. The Ford can't have it both ways. On the one hand, they say they need not disclose the Stimson documents because it had to do with this earlier mechanical system. The earlier system did have electronics in the cruise control system, and that's what the Stimson documents are about. They are about electromagnetic interference causing a sudden acceleration. Now, trend chart discovery. We noticed depositions about trend charts, and Ford informed us that they would not be producing the trend charts before the discovery deadline. So we withdrew the notice of deposition, and that's in the record. The counsel told you that they had produced 12,000 pages of documents. What she neglected to tell you was that we arrived in Dearborn for Mr. Nevi's deposition. He was a Rule 30B6 designated witness on several different areas. And when I got to the hotel, I was given six CDs with 12,000 pages of documents the night before his deposition. So, as I said before, this is not about what was disclosed. It's about when things were disclosed. And by the way, Ms. Warden suggests to you that there is no obligation of a party to immediately comply with its Rule 26 disclosures. And I think there's text here in what you wrote that says that it is required immediately. I think they're turning that law upside down. So, finally, as to the 22 documents that we had from Stimson, that was only a partial set that we were able to obtain from counsel across the country after trial. Right before trial, we had no way to put them into context. We didn't know if these witnesses, which of the witnesses at Ford would know anything about them. We couldn't stop 2 weeks before trial and run off to Dearborn and take depositions of people whom we couldn't even identify. So, again, this is a different matter. But we have asked you not just to consider sending it back for an award of sanctions, but to send it back for proper discovery. But we specifically ask you to say what the proper standard is, because with all due respect, Judge Gilbert had it wrong. And he ignored Rule 26G. He ignored years of precedent that says that sloppy record keeping is not a legitimate excuse for not doing your discovery obligations. Thank you very much.
Counsel, both for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. This is